Last night, I happened to see something strange at the library. The books are quiet all day long, but at night they like to sing some songs. They get the tapes and the CDs out there, start to dance and then they shout, do the library boogie.
Library boogie.
Library boogie.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. That's Tom Knight singing the Library Boogie in the background. This week is National Library Week, and today our librarian worker mole, Joe Clement, is going to bring you commentary about libraries as part of our commons, or spaces which are collectively owned and exist for the benefit of everyone. This might explain why the right wing is so eager these days to either privatize libraries or get rid of them altogether. We also have for you this morning discussions about a couple of events coming up. Next week on April 17 and 18, the International Uranium Film Festival comes to town. One movie you'll see at the festival is Demon Mineral, about the indigenous struggle to reclaim safe and healthy living space in a Southwest landscape that is replete with abandoned uranium mines. Today, Jan Hawkins speaks with documentary filmmaker Hadley Austin about the film. Also next week, on April 19 and 20, is the Social Justice Conference at Washington State University. Desiree Helliger speaks with Julian Ankeny, NIMIPU Director of Native Programs, Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White, and student activist Ash DeBuse about what's on the schedule for the conference. KBOO is volunteer-operated and listener-supported radio. Please, if you can, go to kboo.fm/give and donate today. Now, let's celebrate National Library Week. In the following commentary, Joe Clement draws from a couple of podcasts, Death Panel and Library Punk, and adds his own thoughts to examine the material context of social attacks on libraries.
Good morning. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. A couple weeks ago, I reported on workers fighting for a living wage at Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries. We'll report updates when they come up, but you can continue to support FVRL workers by signing their petition, emailing the library board, and showing up at or live streaming the board meeting on the third Monday of the month. We'll share all that information when the show's posted. Tomorrow, April 9th, is National Library Workers' Day, and this whole week is National Library Week. The theme this year is Ready, Set, Library, with the idea being to turn library from a noun into a verb, highlighting the many ways people do library, a theme we'll return to later. If you're wondering, though, why it's library worker instead of librarian, Ben Webster offers this in his 2013 essay for Viewpoint magazine, Notes of a Library Worker. Quote, "To write of the library worker runs the risk of collapsing the extreme variety of labor performed in these institutions. First, there are a variety of types of libraries, typically subdivided as public, school, academic, or special libraries, that serve different populations and have vastly different types of holdings. Second, each library itself has a division of labor, often complex and highly variegated. The gap between a page in an underfunded urban public library and an archivist at an elite research library may be such that their experiences are mutually unintelligible. Despite this heterogeneity, I believe that the category of the library worker, as opposed to, say, the library page, cataloger, or children's librarian, is useful. It emphasizes the shared working identification with the library, institutions which, despite their variety, have coherence in the social imagination." End quote. Libraries in their diverse species are under attack. Book challenges have risen in the last several years, and by over 90% in 2023 alone. What's more is they are increasingly coming from organized groups like Moms for Liberty. Book bans have been enacted by states, cities, and schools, while some libraries are being defunded and disbanded. In 2022, the city manager of Huntsville, Texas, closed the city library to remove books and dismantle the LGBTQ display. And then last year, the city council voted to privatize management through library systems and services. You might remember them because I reported on them a couple weeks ago as the former employer of the new director of Fort Vancouver Regional Libraries. Also locally, Portland Public Schools is cutting dozens of library staff and open hours. A read-in protest will happen at the next school board meeting on April 23rd at the Matthew Prophet Education Center in Inner North Portland at 501 North Dixon Street. In the media, though, these attacks tend to be framed as a sensational culture war, but below the surface, the mole roots at the class war. Writing for Truthout about how attacks on libraries are attacks on labor, Jamie Taylor argues for a more worker-centric understanding of the situation. Quote, "What we see now are concerted attacks not just on books and authors, but on the expertise of library workers. Nobody knows this better than rank-and-file library workers. If libraries are the terrain of struggle, we are the people most directly involved in the fight. Our efforts are made all the more difficult when our institutions actively work against us. Alongside the very public efforts to ban books from library shelves, library workers face a host of other challenges that directly impact our capacity to do the work necessary to preserve these institutions," end quote. Jamie then describes library management busting the, spoiler alert, ultimately successful union drive in Baltimore County libraries and attacks like what I described already, but then goes on to include, quote, "Core library functions, including collection development and resource description, are contracted out to for-profit private companies that lock us into expensive systems we don't control. These issues may not be as well discussed as Breitbart calling us all groomers, but they are every bit as insidious, stripping our institutions of the very people best positioned to save them. Libraries are crucial social infrastructure. Like the post office, they're a site for the circulation of public goods, such as books and films, but also tax forms, overdose prevention medications, such as Narcan, and COVID tests. Like parks, library buildings produce space for the public where anyone can use the bathroom, grab some computer time, sit down, stay warm in the cold, and cool in the heat. And like all social infrastructure, libraries are under attack from an organized right that knows well that the best way to crater public institutions is to relentlessly attack them until they become unusable, leading to their abandonment by everybody except those who have no other choice. We need a strong library workforce equipped to resist the dismantling of our public institutions." End quote. Libraries are attacked by reactionary right-wing forces from without, but also from within by neoliberal managers who use technology to cut costs by squeezing labor, devaluing collections, re-enclosing library commons through corporate outsourcing. Mariam Kaba is the author of the book Let This Radicalize You and co-founder of For the People, the Leftist Library Project, which aims to systematically research, document, and guide people to access mechanisms of democratic library governance through library boards and different levels of government to push a pro-people, pro-library agenda. She riffs on this theme of libraries under attack with the authors of the book Health Communism on their podcast Death Panel and starts cooking on commenting.
I've been arguing that the public library is probably the last U.S. institution where the word commoning makes any sense at all. And it's for that reason for me that public libraries are important sites of struggle for leftists. And that because public libraries are communal goods, that under capitalism, these goods are always at risk of being privatized or plundered or extracted. And this is precisely why they are under attack by the reactionary right wing. I feel like without that being the center, the free speech stuff is just not it. That's not why they are the center fight for the right. The right has a larger project, y'all, that has been a long-term investment. And we aren't in the same way so explicitly clear about that. You know, we on the left, at least I thought, that our goal in part was to refuse the forced conversion of life forms into market relations, that that was a central value, that we do not want a commodified public library, right? And more importantly, that our goal should be to encourage and expand democratic public control over all our institutions. Like, these are things that I think we somehow, if you talk to people on the left, like, people agree with, but we aren't making it central to our fight and constantly talking about it in the same way that the right is committed to having an ideological and material struggle against these institutions. And for me, I've been thinking a lot. Brett Story, who I really appreciate a lot, who's an abolitionist thinker and filmmaker, did 12 Landscapes in Prison Land. I think it's the name of the film. I have to find the exact thing. I'm sure we can find it and put a link for people. I heard her giving a talk a few years ago, and she mentioned this thing that has stuck with me all the way since. She said that a lot of us in this current moment, like, we don't have a vocabulary or a grammar for the commons anymore. So that means that what's been lost to us is the commons as a way of thinking about, she said, how we belong to each other. And that to me was like, yes. Because for me, interdependence, belonging to each other, all those things are such important, crucial planks in the left political project. And we don't know how to have that conversation in public anymore. We don't have that conversation in explicit terms in common anymore. And libraries, to me, can actually help us to rediscover a grammar for the commons. And that's something we desperately need as we build towards, for me, an abolitionist horizon. So I feel very strongly that the institution of the public library, therefore, is just incredibly important to the broader, larger project on the left in this moment and moving forward. And that's in part why it's so essential for me, especially for young folks who did not grow up steeped in the ideas of commoning or in the ideas of a grammar and a vocabulary for the commons, and aren't steeped in and haven't grown up in a society where our interest is in pushing for an understanding of how we belong to each other. That claiming that space back for this is going to help develop the muscles we need for demands for more public institutions, more public goods. It gives us the grammar for understanding Medicare for all. It gives us the vocabulary for making demands that are beyond individualistic ones and that tell us that we deserve to have public goods that are shared in common for everybody.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We were just listening to Mariam Kaba, abolitionist, library activist, community organizer, and author, talking about the grammar of commons and the social political significance of libraries for the left today and beyond. This connection between libraries and commoning is exactly what the Wrong Boys of the utopian sketch comedy podcast Seriously Wrong have spun into a comprehensive and fun political ideology they call library socialism. Taking the lending library as an intuition pump for socialist economic relations, they develop a set of strategic concepts from dissident Marxist Murray Bookchin's 1982 book, The Ecology of Freedom. Here's a clip of Seriously Wrong host Sean Voyer summarizing it on the leftist library worker podcast, Library Punk. Co-host Justin sets him up.
So did you want to do an introduction to library socialism at the base level and sort of introduce the groundwork concepts? Because I imagine we have one or two listeners who are probably screaming at their phones right now just at the idea of library socialism.
Hi, Steve.
Like, if you work in libraries, and we've talked a lot about like liberal ideology in libraries and democratic discourse in libraries. And so we're always very critical of romanticizing the idea of libraries. It's kind of one of our major things is trying to undermine most of the liberal ideology in the field. And I think that also has made us a little jaded to any kind of utopian thinking about libraries. But it's actually important to do. We used to have the fully automated luxury gay-space communism. Yeah, and then Grimes
ruined
it.
Which we now just turned into our action-oriented question. It's all boring now.
Yeah, well, Grimes ruined the joke.
She did. Elon Musk. I swear to God.
Yeah, so library socialism, it's something we first started sort of describing in 2018 or 2019. And basically what we're attempting to do with it is describe a counter-hegemony, a utopian set of ideas that can be used to challenge neoliberalism, capitalist realism, and so on, to help people imagine a society that is radically different than our own, a society that people would actually want to live in. And we think that's an important thing, to imagine the future that you want to be a part of as part of the process of creating it. And where it came from was, I was thinking about social ecologist Murray Bookchin talks about how the ecological crisis is a social crisis, that the ecological crisis that we face is a result of social relations. It's the brutal hierarchy of society that creates a situation where a small amount of people are making decisions that affect the entire biosphere and so on. So I was sort of thinking about that. And so we have these like two big crises, both caused by that sort of, you know, neoliberal ideology, this everything must be markets, private property is natural, and so on. And it really clicked that the principle of usufruct, so a property relationship where you can use things and you can benefit from them, but you're not allowed to destroy it. It's not private property, it's a sort of commons property, is something that can address both of those issues at once. Because under the current system, we have too many resource throughputs causing an ecological crisis, and people don't get what they need at the same time. So we're overproducing and under-delivering under the current system. So we were sort of thinking about post-scarcity and what it would mean to have a society where everyone was able to get what they need. And that circulating property of usufructian property relations really resonated with us. And the natural metaphor that we leaned into on that was libraries, because libraries already exist and they function on this same logic that we share books. Everyone gets a chance to read the book. No one's allowed to destroy the book. And we don't hoard books. We share them and so on. So that's the basic idea of library socialism, is that we can address the ecological crisis and the social crisis through changing property relations to a usufructian one along the lines of the public library. And in practice, public libraries are very complex. They exist in the real world. They're not a perfectly democratic utopian thing in every instance. Totally want to acknowledge that. But it is a good intuition pump. I think for the majority of people, libraries are a very popular institution when you compare them to other institutions in society. There's a lot of institutional distrust, but libraries people still like. So without abridging our critique of libraries as they actually exist, I think they can be a useful intuition pump for creating that counter-hegemonic narrative for what are we actually searching for when we want to radically recreate society.
That was Sean Voyer talking about library socialism on the leftist library worker podcast, Library Punk. There are hundreds of community tool libraries around the country, more than a few in Portland, as well as more non-traditional collections being offered by public libraries, including Clackamas County Libraries and Hillsborough Libraries. Berkeley Public Library, though, operates the largest public tool library in the country. They have tens of thousands of items. A few weeks ago, Berkeley City Council voted to expand its tool library and develop a share hub. Summer Choi of the Daily Californian reports, quote, "The recommendation to develop Berkeley Public Library's first share hub was approved at Tuesday's council meeting to expand the lending library into a center for community members to access services and supplies. The recommendation was drafted by council member Sophie Hahn, who initiated the idea and worked with the heads of Berkeley libraries. After years of working with Berkeley libraries and authoring the city's plastics ordinance, she noted, the recommendation is a clear way for Berkeley residents to reduce their waste. Hahn said, I want to create a public system for vastly increasing our ability as Berkeley residents to share and reuse a wide variety of items and thereby support our zero waste goals. But I also want to help the library build on its existing tool lending program and make that collection even more relevant and expansive. End quote. This move finally takes seriously the bold mandate of the American Library Association's Statement on Sustainability from 2019, which includes, in adopting sustainability as a core value of librarianship, ALA recognizes the findings in the latest report of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The report, written and edited by 91 scientists from 40 countries who analyzed more than 6,000 scientific studies in October 2018, found that the immediate consequences of climate change are far more dire than originally predicted, calling for a transformation of the world economy at a speed and scale that has no documented historic precedent. End quote. That brings us back to this year's National Library Week theme, Ready, Set, Library, and the question it poses to us, how do you library? For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement. Links to everything will be shared when today's show is posted. Please check out the excellent podcasts Seriously Wrong, Library Punk, and Death Panel.
That was Joe Clement with commentary about the liberatory potential of libraries. The International Uranium Film Festival comes to town next week. These films from around the world are a necessary corrective to a resurgent and dangerous nuclear project. Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, directed by Jan Hocken, and Atomic Cover-Up, directed by Greg Miller, will be showing on Wednesday, April 17. Demon Mineral, directed by Hadley Austin, will play on Thursday, April 18. All screenings will be held at the First Unitarian Church downtown. Doors open at 6 p.m., screenings begin at 6:30 and are followed by Q&A panels. $5 to $20 is the suggested donation at the door. On today's show, Jan Hocken talks with Hadley Austin about Demon Mineral.
Welcome to KBOO, Hadley Austin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's delightful having you on the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning, and I'm also looking forward to your film screening at the International Uranium Film Festival's Portland tour this month on April 17th and 18th. You are a published poet and artist, as well as a documentarian. And Demon Mineral, your first feature film, has won a number of awards. I've seen the film, and it's remarkable for its aesthetic breadth and beauty. The title, Demon Mineral, refers to uranium mining in the American Southwest. The film tells a multi-layered story of the radioactive legacy of uranium mining, largely from the perspectives of Navajo people in the region. Well, every documentary, of course, has an origin story, and some of those origin stories are very complex, as well as the gestational phases of the project itself. So can you talk about how you came into this project and why you and your collaborators took it on?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that lovely intro and bio. I wish I could just carry you around with me, introduce me to people. So the issue itself of uranium contamination and the ways that it impacts day-to-day life, that was an issue that I encountered when I lived in Flagstaff, Arizona, as a young adult. I moved there as an older teenager and lived there into my 20s. And in that time, I did a lot of work on the Navajo Nation, which is just up the road, you know, like Cameron, Arizona, or, you know, Cameron, which is in the Navajo Nation. It's, you know, maybe 20 minutes from where I lived, you know, it's just right there. And at the time, there was an active uranium mine on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, called Canyon Mine. These days it's been reopened. It's called Pinyon Plain. But you know, these things, they were happening in my actual everyday life. And at the time, Yucca Mountain was a proposed storage site. So nuclear waste was coming through town on the highways and on the train on the way to Yucca Mountain, which has since been decommissioned. But, you know, Flagstaff, Arizona and its surrounds, it's a place where there's a lot of just sort of firsthand engagement with that issue. And I had a lot of friends who were elders who lived on land that had to be tested in order to plant their corn or to use spaces for ceremonial reasons. You know, I knew elders who lived in houses that were built out of uranium rock, the rock that had been blasted out of the mines, you know, was later used to build houses, you know. So, you know, as like a young person, this was on my radar. And then many years later, like flash forward many years later, you know, it's like 2016 and everybody is looking at Standing Rock and they're concerned about the Dakota Access Pipeline. And I was really moved by this because I thought, oh, you know, like everybody cares about this water and this water hasn't even been damaged yet, you know? And I was thinking about where I lived, where I knew a lot of people who lived on contaminated water tables and had for generations. And it was the first little like inkling that like, well, what if more people knew about that? What if we were just talking about that more broadly again? Because to be clear, there have been moments in history where this has been just sort of a thing that was discussed and talked about. In fact, during the pandemic, for instance, lack of water access in the Navajo Nation and its link to mining was discussed, you know. So it cycles through.
You make a point in the film of the difference between Three Mile Island, that, you know, rocked the news and still reverberates and has been underreported, but nonetheless is seen as one of the major accidents in nuclear history and its horrific legacy in this country, and accidented a dam there, and how little notice or news of that happened.
Oh yeah, the Church Rock spill was catastrophic. And, you know, it absolutely, that contaminated water went into Gallup and, you know, other places that where people live. But people lived right there at the Church Rock mine site too. In fact, Terry Kayana, who opens the film, is from right there. That's her home. And yeah, very, very underreported. You know, in fact, I don't think a lot of people know this, but, you know, like that whole area was deemed essentially like federally a wasteland. You know, it was called, Nixon called it the sacrifice zone. And that was an official designation.
And a number of the people in the film who speak from the area and their attachment, deep attachment to the area, describe being told by others, why don't you just leave? Why are you still living in this godforsaken place that is such a disaster zone? And I thought the way that you gave their stories time and space and kind of a creative scope was quite remarkable in terms of the attachment to place.
I think it's really important to consider other relationships to place. You know, I don't think that the Western concept of place or home, well, it has a lot of limitations, right? We look at something for its aesthetic offering. We look at something for its financial offering. And we don't consider the fact that, you know, for instance, place has a better effect on psychology than things. Like, this has been proven. You know, we don't consider that, like, we literally are made up of the stuff of a place. You know, your bones, your teeth, all of that reflect where you lived. But I think another thing that people do that, like, it's understandable why they do it, but you know, it's a limiting sort of perspective, is they look at an issue in a place like the Navajo Nation and they go, oh, well, that's very remote. It's very rural. It's not where I live. Those people don't even look like me. They're not even speaking English or whatever. And they don't realize that what happens there affects us all, not just on the environmental level, because of course everything is interconnected, but on a policy level. Just one example of this, for instance, the Navajo Nation sued the state of Arizona because they don't currently have access to clean water. And that is, of course, a byproduct of mining and abuse of the land. And that mining and abuse of the land was, of course, done with Western interests and Western profits. So, you know, anyway, they sued the state of Arizona, went all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 2019, no, it was more recent than that, but the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the state of Arizona and said, essentially, like, the state does not have to provide clean water. And that, of course, sets a legal precedent, right? And that affects us all. So, like, what happens there does matter, you know, to all of us for so many reasons.
I'd like to also ask you about some of your aesthetic choices. I mean, the film is, I think, a piece of art as well as an informative, insightful documentary. And you make some unconventional choices, you and your team, and your choices of music and artistic elements. I understand that you're also you've been trained as a trapeze artist. So
I am a trained trapeze artist.
I was watching the film, I thought, I wonder where she might be hanging from here with the camera. But one of those choices was to bring the narrator, who usually, if you have a narrator, you hear a voiceover and you might see the name. Usually it's a famous person. But you see the narrator in a studio, so you know it's a highly produced film. But tell us about the role of the narrator in this, because often, of course, the narrator device is rejected because it implies a kind of voice of God, you know, a kind of overseeing intelligence. So some documentarians don't like to use a narrator. Can you tell us about that choice?
Absolutely. Emma Robbins narrated the film and she did a beautiful job. She's a Diné artist and activist. At the time she was working for Dig Deep. She no longer is, but they deliver water on the Navajo Nation in areas where people can't dig wells because of a contaminated water table. And I chose to to show Emma in the studio for so many reasons. One was that the film constantly is sort of playing with showing you that it's constructed. It's showing you its construction many moments all throughout. In fact, so many times I apologize to Yoni, the DP. I'm like, I know this isn't your best shot, because it's like a shot where he's like adjusting focus, or he's, you know, adjusting exposure. And I mean, that's why I put it in, you know, to show like this is constructed. We all made this thing.
Yeah, there's even one scene where a guy in a truck is saying off camera, this filmmaker wants to come with me, and I guess she's pretty pushy, so I better do it, but I do not have my best clothes on today. And, you know, most people would not include that in the film. I thought, oh, that is so right on. Yes, you have to be pushy to do this kind of work. But it was clearly friendly, clearly bought into the project. So there were some very delightful elements like that. So yeah, that was part of the bringing the narrator in and showing that process. And it didn't distract, I think, at all from the content.
Well, I also really wanted you to see that the voice of God is a Dene woman. You know, this is a woman from this community who is narrating this. And actually, you can see a reflection of me every once in a while in the door of the...
When I watch it again at the festival here, I will notice some of these subtleties. You also talk about Dene culture as matriarchal, or having this matrilineal traditions. And can you speak to that aspect of the film as a feminist project, or a project guided by those commitments?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's important to clarify that I'm not Dene. You know, and this was my home, but it's not my ancestral home. And it's a place that I love. But of course, my connection there is culturally different. These women who are in the film, it's all women except for Dr. Rock.
Who was a co-writer, though. I mean, he seemed to have been very deeply involved in the project.
Oh, very, very. And we're so grateful. What a fun time it was collaborating with him. Yeah, he's so great, and gave a lot of scientific oversight, too, which was obviously absolutely necessary. This is absolutely a feminist work, right? A feminist made this film with a bunch of women. You know, when you hang out in Dene spaces and you talk about any kind of Western impact, it goes in the direction of, you know, a patriarchal culture negatively impacting a matriarchal culture, and a discussion of the effect that has had on the women in that space pretty quickly, almost every time. And it was also important to me to show that women just physiologically are at greater risk.
Radioactivity and, and radioactive toxins.
Yes, because of just, well, women and people with uteruses, you know, they're at greater biological risk. Not that that in any way diminishes the risk that men are exposed to. And of course, men often have the more dangerous jobs.
You know, I think mining.
And one of the reasons that so many women are in this film and not so many men is because a lot of the men are dead. And I think that's also worth noting.
You know, there was one scene where I think it was Dr. Rock before a congressional hearing was trapped. It was kind of one of those gotcha moments, like the three presidents of the universities who were grilled and caught in a question that required a much more complex answer than the time provided. And he was asked, are mortality rates worse or better among the Navajo people? And then he said, actually, they're better, but he was not given space to explain that. And you did get the sense of it being a kind of grilling. The viewer, what was the viewer of the film expected to conclude from that? Because there are so many ways in which people continue in those areas to fight for the health of their children, and have, I suppose you could say, the history of activism and fighting against all of this has helped benefit the area, as well as continuing cancer rates being a problem. I mean, these are complicated questions, but it kind of left him flat-footed there in that hearing.
Well, and that was certainly done on purpose, right?
Because
of course, the reality is we're all living longer. I mean, that may not be true for my generation, right? Like all the stats show that maybe we will not live as long as our parents' generation, but we don't know yet. So far, everybody's living longer. And so, of course, everyone on the Navajo Nation is living longer. This is a national trend. But, you know, of course, cancer rates are higher there than they are, you know, just per capita in other places. But it's not just cancer that this affects, you know, like thyroid issues are related to contamination exposure, you know, like radioactive exposure, higher rates of thyroid concerns, higher rates of respiratory issues, higher rates of kidney disease, all of these things that are negative health outcomes. And, you know, Dr. Rock wasn't given a chance to say any of that. But another thing you brought up in your comment that I think is really important is acknowledging the work that's been done for generations. You know, like I brought up earlier, the folks who were living in uranium rock houses when I lived out on the border of the Navajo Nation. And then when I went out 20 years later, making this film with Yoni, we couldn't find one. And that's great. You know, we have to celebrate the successes because improvements can always be made. And those successes absolutely, as you say, come as a result of the very hard work of multi-generational activist efforts. You know, people literally put their all into this and it is a matter of survival, you know, and the film, one of the things we wanted to do was celebrate that and acknowledge that work.
I think that's a nice segue to talking about the broader project of the International Uranium Film Festival. And you've been in some of their European parts of their worldwide tours, Atomic Bamboozle, my film produced with a team here in Portland is going to be in 4 cities in the Pacific Northwest and 3 other cities in the North America tour.
Congratulations.
And I feel very proud to be paired with you and Atomic Cover Up, another fabulous film. And these are all films that have, different topics, clearly on different aspects of the nuclear industry, all the way from atomic bombs and weapons to the history of nuclear power and accidents and impacts on Indigenous people that are most vulnerable to this deathly industry. What do you see your part or what do you hope your part will be in this broader project of bringing nuclear issues into the environmental justice movement? And I have found myself that it's been heavy lifting to get many, even climate activists, to see the nuclear issues as part of environmental justice. Can you say a little about that before closing?
So much to say. I think we live in a really challenging moment in that there's a lot of information. It's everywhere. So there's a lot for people to sift through. But also we live in a moment right now where the nuclear lobby and the uranium mining lobby, they have a lot of money and they have a lot of influence right now, in large part because, you know, the United States banned Russian imports of uranium. And Russia, of course, you know, controlled a lot of the trade that was coming out of Kazakhstan. And since our, by U.S. standards, friendlier compatriots, Canada, Australia, you know, they have severely limited uranium mining and stopped exporting uranium for obvious reasons. You know, suddenly there's a supply and demand shift in the United States. And all of a sudden, for the first time in many years, the price of uranium has skyrocketed. And so we see new mining and we see this push for uranium and nuclear-oriented power sources as quote-unquote stopgap power sources. You know, it was written into the Green New Deal proposal, all of this stuff. Right. And I think people don't understand.
This great redeemer is as much of a hustle as Donald Trump selling his Bibles for $60.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And they don't understand. Yes, we could call it a hustle, I think, very accurately. And I think they don't understand that this is about already wealthy people making more money. This is not about building a healthy infrastructure for American citizens. This is not about creating a greener America or a greener world. Right.
Or dealing with the climate emergency in a way that is meaningful.
Oh, absolutely not. And people don't understand that nuclear power is not green, you know? And I think if people did understand, you know, they would feel differently. And I do think that we are all of us who are engaging in this work, right, in this moment, fighting an uphill battle against some folks, some entities that have a lot more money and resources than we do. But I also see us as doing the kind of work that is literally forever work, there are so many elders in Demon Mineral. And the reason for that is to acknowledge their work, but also to acknowledge that, like, this has been a concern since they were children. And this will be a concern after we are dead. And that is just a fact. You know, we have to keep doing our part. We are links in the chain. It's really important that we keep linking the chain, you know?
Yes.
And so we do it.
And to do it in a way that also provides joy, inspiration, and aesthetic pleasures. And I must say, your film delivers on all those fronts. And
thank you.
I hope that we get a good turnout here in Portland and look forward to hearing your progress. We'll be on the road a lot, so we'll have another road report. Thank you so much for being with us today, Hadley Austin.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, on the Old Mole Hour this morning, talking about your film, Demon Mineral, that will be part of the International Uranium Film Festival screening here on April 17th and 18th at the Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was music from the soundtrack to Demon Mineral. Before that, Jan Hocken spoke with filmmaker Hadley Austin about her film. You can see Demon Mineral next week on Thursday, April 18. On Wednesday, April 17, two films will be shown, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of the Nuclear Renaissance, and Atomic Cover-Up. All screenings will be held at the First Unitarian Church, doors open at 6 p.m. Every year in the spring, Washington State University in Vancouver hosts their annual Social Justice Conference, which is free and open to the public. The conference runs Friday, April 19, and Saturday, April 20, with sessions both in person and on Zoom. A link to the schedule of events will be posted on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. This year's conference is aimed at building coalitions at the intersections of extraction, militarism, and climate collapse. Here's Desiree Helliger's In Conversation with Julian Ankeny, Robin White, and Ash DeBuse about what's featured this year at the conference.
Good morning. I'm speaking this morning with Nimipu Mole Julian Ankeny, who, when not producing segments for the Old Mole, is the director of Native Programs at Washington State University, Vancouver, the co-director of WSU's Visiting Writers Program, and is also right now very busy helping to coordinate the SJCon Social Justice Conference, which she was also centrally involved in launching 5 years ago. And also with us here this morning is Lakota Cheyenne Mole Robin White, who is an artist and a longtime organizer who's participated for several years now in SJCon. And finally, also with us here this morning is Ash DeBuse, who is a WSU undergrad and a student organizer with the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice. Ash is majoring in environmental sciences and minoring in queer studies and in women's gender and sexuality studies. And so thanks all for joining us this morning to talk about the conference, which is coming up on April 19th and 20th. The conference is free, open to the public. It is predominantly virtual on Zoom this year, and it's focused this year on health and environmental justice, constructing coalitions at the intersections of extraction, militarism, and climate collapse. Ash, since you have to leave here in a bit, why don't you start us out and maybe just tell us a little bit about some of the connections that you're making to climate collapse and how boycotts and divestment kind of fit in with this constellation of issues.
Absolutely. So from annual reports from the IPCC, or Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in 2023, globally, our carbon emissions hit a new record high. Globally, in 2023, our carbon emissions hit a new record high. Low-wealth frontline climate communities in the U.S. and around the world are experiencing increasingly erratic and catastrophic weather. Climate collapse is the byproduct of colonial violence and imperialism, and climate justice organizing has yet to step up to tackle the carbon impacts of war and militarism. Whereas the U.S. military is the largest single institutional emitter of carbon worldwide. The economy of the Pacific Northwest in particular is interwoven with the military-industrial carceral complex, and BIPOC communities, both here and abroad, bear disproportionate environmental burdens from tsunamis to nuclear waste to oil and chemical spills. As of 2022, over 1,500 institutions globally that have over $40 trillion in assets have committed to some level of fossil fuel divestment, but more action is needed. We need to mobilize institutions of higher education, faith communities, unions, and local and state governments to divest from these extractive industries and the war industries that they fuel. As activists and community organizers, we need to move beyond theory. Social justice requires action, and that action must be rooted in lived experiences and in the land that connects us all.
You are going to be presenting on a panel on gendered violence. Do you want to talk a little bit about that panel and about some of the work that you're doing and that you're going to be speaking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So the particular panel that I will be presenting on is about gendered violence, and my particular presentation is looking at current events in the United States and the United Nations definition of genocide and how transgender identities are under attack in a way that fulfills the UN's definition of genocide. The presentation that I have also includes gender and feminist theory and demonstrates that all oppression is linked by the systems of oppression and the methods that those systems use.
KBOO's own Emma Lugo is also going to be presenting on that panel and is going to be talking about the legislative assault on transgender rights in the U.S. And also on that panel is Nishant Shahani, professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at WSU Vancouver. And he will be speaking about Israeli pinkwashing. And we just want to note also that Emma Lugo will also be on the plenary panel. Emma is also with Jewish Voice for Peace, and we will be obviously making those urgent connections to the genocide that's unfolding in Gaza. You're not presenting on a panel that's exclusively an undergrad panel, but we do have a number of panels that are going to be specifically featuring undergraduate presentations. So I know you got to run, Ash. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
These conversations are particularly important. This particular conference, I think, is doing its best to bring all of these issues together that are connected. And I think that the more people can see that, the better. This isn't my issue is more important than your issue. It's we are connected by these issues. They impact different people in different ways, but we are not in silos. We are not separated from each other. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks so much, Ash. And Robin, you're going to be speaking on a panel about the Thin Green Line as People, this history project. Did you want to tell us a little bit about the project and why you think it's important?
Yeah, the Thin Green Line is an incredible historical archive online that's been kind of a goldmine for activists and organizers to find relational materials as far as journalism, being able to see a lot of documents on there related to all fossil fuel activism projects in Washington State or in the Northwest in general, just really has a lot of different things. We'd like it to be something that's perpetuated by the activists that are working in the Northwest and organizations that are working in the Northwest, so that it's a continued effort and a continued place for activists and organizers to come. One of the important things about it is we have a speakers bureau tied to the Thin Green Line as People. And these are some extraordinary people from the Northwest and from other places that have worked as activists in the fossil fuel fights in the Northwest. There's a lot of representation of Native peoples in particular, and people that are most affected by fossil fuels and climate collapse. If you are a school, particularly in Oregon, you can have these speakers come at no cost. We'd love to set that up for you if you're interested. As a school in Oregon, whether that's a high school or higher ed, please get a hold of Julian Ankeny. And I believe that's julian.ankeny@wsu.edu. We were lucky enough to be funded by the Spirit Mountain Fund, the Grand Ronde. These Speakers Bureau will run through May as a paid Speakers Bureau. So please get in line quickly and make reservations. We're running out of speaker slots. We also have developed a curriculum that goes along with this for the school systems and for others that are interested, thanks to Angie Morrill from the Klamath Tribe.
And as part of that same panel, we're also going to hear from some WSU undergrads who worked with Professor Patty Wild to develop curriculum for other undergraduate students from those documents. So, Julian, do you want to tell us about some of the other panels and a little bit of the history of the conference as well?
Yes, thank you, Desiree. So WSU SJCon is an interdisciplinary social justice conference that came into fruition from the labor organizer and all-around brilliant mind of Catherine Manis. And then SJCon was then launched in 2019 by WSU Pullman graduate students in coalition with BIPOC and LGBTQIA 2S-led groups. We have since migrated to WSU Vancouver, where we have made it our new home. We're so happy here. And then we have also accepted proposals on presentations, panels, film screenings, creative and multimedia art, community-led tours by regional activists, and plenary sessions that focus on action-based approaches to building and sustaining coalitions across community. Yeah, and here is a little snapshot of a few of our panels, beginning with a panel on artivism, art and movement building, resistance, resilience, and reclamation. This panel has an absolutely amazing lineup of artists. So you have to register for this conference. We have another panel by the Columbia River Keepers that they are doing on the Bradford Island Superfund cleanup. It just brings me so much joy to also have a jam-packed day of events as well for our joint WSU Vancouver and Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, CSEJ, and Native American Programs fundraiser. On Sunday the 21st, we will be featuring a tour from the founding member of the Portland chapter of the Black Panthers in North Portland, Kent Ford. And we are also featuring a few different screenings by Indigenous director and filmmaker, also a WSU alumnus, Misty Shipman, enrolled member of the Shoalwater Bay Tribe of Indians, called The Handsome Man, literally starring Lily Gladstone and Evan Adams. Woo! This is another win for Indian country. WSU alum. Another film is called Atomic Bamboozle that tells the story of the nuclear resurgence and how the nuclear industry is repackaging nuclear power as safe. And lastly, a film called Radioactive, The Women of 3 Mile Island. For further information, please contact the beautiful Desiree Helligers. That is Desiree Helligers at WSU.edu. Katsiao yao. Thank you so much.
Katsiao yao, Julian. Thank you. So the conference is Friday and Saturday, and then on Sunday, you've got just a day that's jammed full of events afterward. And so the fundraiser that you're talking about is at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Vancouver, Washington, and that's 4505 East 18th Street. So we'll be posting more of that information on the conference website, which we will post along with the show on Monday. I just want to note also that at that fundraiser on Sunday at the Unitarian Universalist Church, filmmaker Misty Shipman will be there on hand to talk about her films. Filmmaker Jan Hocken will also be talking about Atomic Bamboozle, and filmmaker Heidi Huttner will be speaking virtually. And so, Julian, can you talk a little bit more about the garden that the fundraiser is going to be helping to support? WSU Vancouver has a new garden or new gardens.
Yes, yeah, Desiree, once again. The garden is really going to center and uplift the legacy of Indigenous knowledge holders so that they can in turn share their experiential knowledge for the benefit of students, for Indigenous students and WSU students, but also the larger community. So our ancestors have created this pathway into the future that have always been centered and uplifted food sovereignty, sustainability, and community-centered regenerative food economies and infrastructures. So again, these pathways really center knowledge for the preparation and cultivation of our futures, centering Indigenous ecological knowledge, environmental activists, artivists, infrastructure innovation, and community support, featuring, you know, Native environmental stewards that have the potential to benefit and influence more than just Native community. Indigenous people hold the solution to these expanding problems through our respective traditional teachings, ancestral lifeways and landscapes that spurred our ancestors to optimize collective, reciprocal, and also regenerative systems and economies embedded with innovation and place-based systems from, that again, sprang from our ancestral knowledge holders. And again, these are not new ideas. These systems in turn cultivate community self-reliance, determination, and the resiliency that's really centering community. And again, food sovereignty, not only for students, but we're also centering our Indigenous veterans and all our veterans and students on campus. So we're really trying to have an impact on, you know, the community at large. Katsiyao
Yao,
thank you.
Oh, Katsiyao Yao, Julian. And I just think it probably bears reminding our listeners that WSU is still in possession of, I think, about 80% of the original Morrill land grab. So it's still in possession of about 71,000 acres of Indigenous land. And how much is WSU gleaning every year from Indigenous land trusts?
I've kind of heard conflicting stories. I've heard some 15 million, others say 20 million. But we can say 15 to 20 million. What's 5 million profiting from, you know, Indigenous or and occupying Indigenous lands? So there's an element of reciprocity, right, that universities are finally stepping up and becoming real people, becoming the people that they should be, but also supporting the people that they should be supporting. So this is really, really great. I feel like time for Indigenous knowledge holders and uplifting, you know, the teachings, the lessons, life lessons from our ancestors. Again, like, none of these ideas are new. Okay. These are systems, right, economies that have been handed down from us since time immemorial that are in reciprocal relationship with the land. The land is living.
So the conference again on April 19th and 20th is free and open to the public. And you can register at tinyurl.com/567CAVKJ. That's tinyurl.com/567CAVKJ. Katsiyao Yao, and thanks again to Julian Ankeny and Robin White, as well as Ash DeBuse. We will see you hopefully on April 19th, 20th, and 21st.
That was Desiree Hellegers with fellow activists about the Social Justice Conference next week. A link to the schedule of events will be posted on the webpage for this segment at kboo.fm. That's it for our show today. I want to thank Moles, Joe Clement, Jan Hocken, Desiree Hellegers, Julian Ankeny, and Robin White for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guests, Hadley Austin and Ash DeBuse. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host this morning. I'm going to sign off with a little more of Tom Knight with Library Boogie.
That's what I'm talking about. Get a library card and then you can check it out.
Check it out, check it out, check it out.
And Peter Rabbit said something funny to Winnie the Pooh, who was eating some honey.